select meeting of the House Sustainable Infrastructure and Policy Committee for January 11th to order. A quorum is present, so we will get started. Thanks, everybody, for being on time. I know it was difficult. Seems like the weather is conspiring against this committee. We do have a number of presentations today, but our first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. So, Representative Curran, would you like to move the minute?
So moved.
Thank you. So, Representative Curran moves the approval of the minutes for January 4th, 2023. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. All right. So do we have the folks from, okay, great. So to start off our presentations, we'll have Mr. Tom Kolasich. Did I get that right?
Kolasich.
From the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, give a presentation about the resiliency chapter of the Minnesota Climate Action Framework. Members can find a copy of each of today's presentations in your folders. For members' reference, we've also put a copy of the framework in each of your committee's folders and posted it to our committee webpage. So, Mr. Kolasich, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Great. Thank you and good morning. My name is Frank Kolasich. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Air and Climate Policy with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I use he, him pronouns. I'll begin this presentation with an overview of the Climate Action Framework that was released in September of 2022, but also talk about the work of climate resiliency that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is focusing on currently with funding that we had previously and also where we're going into the future. And next slide, please. So I want to start off my presentation by sharing a little bit about the importance of building resilience. Minnesota is already experiencing the direct impacts of climate change. Our state is becoming warmer and wetter. We are seeing more frequent and damaging storms and losing our coldest winter temperatures. Today, there are more than 155,000 residential properties, 29,000 miles of roads, and 13,000 commercial buildings in Minnesota that are at risk for severe flooding, and we know that these numbers are going to rise. This photo was taken after the Duluth flood of 2012, which has had lasting, devastating impacts on the city. These impacts and others pose destructive challenges to Minnesota's communities, and we must act now to protect our communities and landscapes for changes that are already underway and that we know are unavoidable. If local governments are not equipped to manage these changes, residents and businesses will continue to bear the brunt of this destruction. It is our role in state government to be a partner in assessing community adaptation needs, developing plans to guide the work, and implementing updates at the community level so that our state is climate resilient as a whole. Next slide. In 2022, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency conducted our third climate adaptation survey to understand the number of local governments that have taken steps to prepare for the impacts of climate change and the tools they need to continue this work. We received 380 responses from local governments in every region of the state, including cities, counties, and tribal nations. In the survey, 87% of local governments said that they had experienced the impact of one climate change trend in their community over the past few years. And in addition, 42% of the survey respondents said they needed financial assistance for infrastructure upgrades as well as for planning efforts. And also 42% indicated they needed guidance on the best practice for building climate resiliency in their communities. The framework itself, sorry, I have my sheet turned over. So now I'm going to turn to talk about the Climate Action Framework, which the Climate Change Subcabinet released in September of 2022. It's important to note that climate change comes to mind and is integrated in all of the work that we do to make sure that Minnesota is a great place to live and that critical services of local government and tribal governments provide to each day continue to be available. And that's one result we hope to see from the Climate Action Framework, which we officially launched in September. The framework acknowledges that climate change is already upon us and that we need to act now for future impacts. We heard this urgency echoed from more than 3,000 Minnesotans that provided input on this framework. And while the challenges are many, so too are the opportunities. This is a historic chance to strengthen our economy, improve our health, create a more equitable Minnesota for everyone, which is critical, because while climate change affects everyone, some communities are hit harder by climate change than others. And this framework sets a vision for how our state will address and prepare for climate change, identifies what we can do now and in the near future, and then holds us accountable for moving future. Each chapter within the framework itself focuses on either a major emission sector or a cross-cutting sector within climate change impacts. So there are six goal chapters within the framework, focusing on clean transportation, climate smart and natural and working lands, resilient communities, clean energy and efficient buildings, healthy lives and communities, and building a clean economy. Within each framework goal, we provide a summary of the challenges that we will face to meet each goal, priority actions and large initiatives that are needed to achieve the goal, measures to help gauge our progress, and equity considerations and opportunities for addressing disadvantaged communities and other disproportionate impacts upon other Minnesotans. And together, we think that achieving these goals will result in the ultimate vision of the Climate Action Framework, which is reducing emissions, building climate resiliency, and building an equitable future for our state. Looking more specifically at the Resilient Communities chapter, we have a vision that Minnesota's communities will have the resources and support they need to plan and implement projects to build more resilient futures for themselves. Systems and extreme events. I want to also note that climate resiliency appears in other chapters of the framework, including the Clean Transportation chapter, the Climate Smart Natural and Working Lands chapter, and the Healthy Lives and Communities chapter. Looking more specifically at the three priorities within the framework we have in the Resilient Community chapters, we want to ensure that our communities are climate smart and prepared for and building the capacity to protect against and withstand against the effects of climate change. We also want to expand and protect tree canopies, parks and other green spaces, lakes, rivers, and wetlands that provide community resilience benefits. We also want to help the built environment and local economies become more resilient to climate change and avoid the most devastating impacts of a warmer and wetter Minnesota. My slides do not have this printed, but I will, there it is. Within the Climate Smart Communities priority that we have, we also have some specific initiatives we want to be focusing on in the near future. And that is understanding, responding to, listening to communities in Minnesota who have indicated that they need technical assistance, tools, maps, and other data sources available to them so that they can effectively plan for climate resiliency in their communities and focus their efforts to ensure that their citizens and their residents receive the critical services they provide. We also want to identify and prioritize federal, state, and local funds that can be invested in building community resiliency and supplemented by private funding sources as well. And finally, we want to create community connections that circulate successful adaptation strategies and projects that build upon capacity through Green Step Cities, Minnesota Green Corps, and pilot projects with tribal nations, schools, school districts, and counties as well. When we look at the healthy community and green spaces, we want to expand tree planting and preservation because we know that trees and shade trees in urban areas are a remedy for heat island effects and that help decrease energy use in our homes, and managing tree stressors is a critical importance of this, including the impacts of emerald ash borer in Minnesota. And it is particularly important that we involve and include low-income and marginalized communities when making decisions and planning for the way that we grow trees and we plant and protect our urban tree canopies. We also see advantages in parks, community gardens, yards, and other public and private green spaces, and how their vegetation can lower temperatures and provide habitat and manage stormwater. Growing native climate-adaptive species in these areas can also support pollinators, protect biodiversity, boost ecosystem resiliency, and the food web. And then finally, Minnesota's groundwater and our many lakes, rivers, and wetlands support ecosystems, provide drinking water, offer recreation, sustain industries and food producers, and bear important cultural and spiritual significance for us, and building climate resiliency into those resources is critical. Looking at the resilient buildings, infrastructure, and businesses priority for this chapter, we know we must work together to ensure buildings are able to withstand extreme precipitation, flooding, extended heat waves, and urban heat islands, and grid failures caused by climate change. New research and innovation and design standards are also needed to ensure buildings are climate resilient. We must support the building and maintenance of climate-ready water, wastewater treatment facilities, hospitals, energy infrastructure, roadways, and other critical facilities and infrastructure to ensure they are accessible to continue and operate during and after extreme weather. Next slide. Now turning to what the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been doing for climate resiliency and our assistance communities, in 2021 we received funding to provide funds to local units of government and to tribal nations planning grants for climate resiliency. We started out with the first round in 2022. We were able to fund 12 grantees at a total level of $920,000. Within that application, we received 49 requests for funding for nearly $3 million in total. A couple of the funded projects that address planning and urban heat island mitigation, and one project combines planning for all three categories of resiliency for wastewater, resiliency for stormwater, and resiliency for communities. Our second funding round of funding is now in progress. At the end of 2022, we closed a round of applications for communities with a population below 10,000, in which we have $345,000 available. Applications close tomorrow, January 12th, for a second pool of funding for local governments and tribal nations of all sizes, and there's $395,000 available for that. We are also working to provide access to additional federal funds to help communities plan for resiliency in their wastewater and stormwater systems. I want to emphasize these are only planning grants that we were able to provide for cities at this level of funding. In 2022, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency had a proposal that would expand the funding for that to include significant amounts of money for the implementation of projects that were built under those plans by our local units of government and tribal nations. We continue to look at also the opportunities and the ability to provide technical assistance to local units of government, tribal nations, to ensure that they have the tools and the information and the capacity available to both do the planning, do the assessments, and understand the priority projects that they have, and also be able to identify funding sources, particularly in light of the federal funding coming through the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the Inflation Reduction Act going forward. We hope to continue to provide these kinds of technical assistance to our communities moving forward and be able to meet the goals and the measures of progress that are listed within the Climate Action Framework to ensure all Minnesotans are living in communities that are resilient for the changing climate in a warmer and wetter Minnesota. And again, I just wanted to emphasize this is a brief overview of the Climate Action Framework. I welcome questions if there is time for them now, and otherwise we will turn over the rest of the time to the committee.
We will take questions between each presentation, and so if any members have questions for Mr. Kolash, please look. Representative Gilman, thank
you. Thank you, Chair. Real quick question. With Dutch elm disease back in the 70s and 80s, what was the response, do you know the response then to what tree was planted to combat that? And then as you talk about tree planting, curious if you'll have diversity in species based on ash being the one that was.
Mr. Kolash?
Yes. Madam Chair and Representative, yes, you're correct. My understanding is that the ash was the primary choice to replace elm trees during the Dutch elm replacement, and that creates a challenge for us now, obviously, with emerald ash borer. But to your question about diverse species, yes, that is a clear point that we're looking at, and particularly looking at climate resilient species that are going to be able to thrive in Minnesota as we anticipate a changing climate heading into the next decades. As we plant those trees, we want to make sure that they are planted in a way that continues to provide the services intended over multiple decades.
So just one follow-up question with that.
Representative
Gilman. Oh, sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So as you look at the species that you're going to replace the ash with and just, you know, help create canopy, are you looking in other areas where those are planted and if there's any issues with them to prevent 30, you know, 40 years from now, people having to sit here and, you know, talk about those issues where we even invest the dollars? It sounded like it was like 20-some million that was invested back in the 80s for the Dutch elm, and now we're just looking at just being wise stewards of taxpayer dollars.
Mr. Kolesch?
Yep. Madam Chair and Representative, that is an issue that is best directed to the Department of Natural Resources, but in the discussions that we've had within the Climate Action Framework, that item was first and foremost. It was top of the list as we talked about sustainable forestry management, but also within the building of using trees for building resiliency, making sure that we avoid those impacts that you just described.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks.
Representative Franson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Kolesch, I've got this article in front of me here. Is limiting population growth key to climate change? And it's written by a professor in the Department of Philosophy at the Colorado State University.
Mr. Kolesch?
I haven't asked my question.
In
the article, it says, one example of this developing open-mindedness has been a surge in scientific discussions around population related to climate change. In 2019, warning of a climate emergency signed by over 11,000 scientists, forthrightly described continued increases in human population and the world gross domestic product as a profoundly troubling signs of ecological decline. It stated the world population must be stabilized and ideally gradually reduced within a framework that ensures social integrity. Addressing population, therefore, must be part of humanity's response to global climate change. And so it continues on with, faced with the reality of global climate change and its devastating impacts, climate ethicists have begun to add their voice to the scientists and environmental activists who support addressing population and facing limits to growth. So I'm just wondering if the Minnesota framework group discussed recommending a climate-friendly family size. If not, why not?
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, I'm not aware that that issue was ever brought up in any of our work groups or discussions within the Climate Action Framework.
So we're not concerned about family size at all contributing to the carbon output or anything to do with climate?
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, again, those issues never came up in our discussions. We think that there are, as represented within the Climate Action Framework, more than 200 different actions available that was not one of those. So we think that there are many more actions available for us.
Representative Franzen.
Well, yesterday I read that the Biden administration is coming after our gas stoves. So do you see in the future that possibly population growth is going to be a discussion on climate and limiting family sizes?
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Franson, that has not come up in any of the climate discussions we've had at the state or with our partners at the federal level.
And I can promise you that wouldn't be something I would want to pursue at all. I think,
but it is a conversation that is taking place. I mean, there's all kinds of people that would pursue this.
Yeah. Well, luckily
policy.
We're the ones here, so
for now.
Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question is on the slide about healthy communities and green spaces and water resources. So I'm very proud to represent a district with probably the best air quality and the cleanest water quality in the entire state of Minnesota. And my question was about the expanding tree planting and preservation. I'm a huge proponent for expanding our forests and continual tree growth. But my question there is, what does the agency mean when you talk about preservation? You know, is that long-standing growth forests or I just want some clarification on that.
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, Within that context, we primarily are talking about the protection of trees in response to emerald ash borer. That it's not just about totally and immediately removing all ash trees, but also being able to treat those and have that be part of the management. But then further on protecting forests, I would direct those questions to the Department of Natural Resources because they also are talking about the protection of our state forest resources as well.
Representative Igoe?
I just wanted to follow up and say, because, you know, whenever I see that word, you know, we need to make sure we understand forestry, and whenever I have an opportunity to talk about it, I like to. You know, the best way to sequester carbon out of the atmosphere and produce more oxygen and clean up the environment is actually a young growth forest. You know, and whenever we log, we start those young growth forests, and we actually sequester more carbon from that forest. It's the best way to keep our environment clean and prevent against, you know, future insect infestations as well as fires. So I just, you know, we need to keep that conversation in mind when we're having these things so we don't forget about these conversations. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Franson?
Thank you, Mr. Kolash. So as I read the Minnesota Climate Action framework here, I was unable to see how many degrees of global warming it would prevent. Could you let us know what that number is?
Representative Kolash, or Mr.
Kolash. Madam Chair, Representative Franson, we did not calculate the actual temperature change that we receive with the emissions, the reductions that we would see. What we are looking at is being part of the global system that is going to reduce temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius by mid-century. And that's our primary target based on collective action of a number of the nations and other subnational entities that are focused on reducing emissions to meet that 1.5 degree or 2 degree Celsius warming.
Representative Franzen?
Uh-huh. And so what guarantee do the taxpayers of Minnesota who are seeing higher energy costs have that your goals are going to work? Right now it seems just like a wealth or a transfer of wealth.
Mr. Kolash?
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, we also look within the climate action framework of multiple co-benefits that we see. So when we reduce emissions from our electric generation sector by having more wind and solar on our grid, then we are not as reliant upon importing coal, and we have our own homegrown energy sources. We also see benefits to our water quality, benefits to our air quality, benefits to our soil health, and making sure that Minnesota is prepared for a clean economy as we go forward, because we are seeing the urgency and the need to address climate change because of the impacts that we see on a year-to-year basis with a warmer and wetter Minnesota, with more extreme weather, more extreme storms, more extreme precipitation events happening in Minnesota, and the impacts that that has on the services that we have to provide to Minnesotans and making sure they all have access to those critical services and also can recover from the growing impacts of climate change with more extreme events that are happening in Minnesota.
And I think, too, one thing I want to focus on in this committee is, you know, we have the Climate and Energy Committee that addresses, you know, they're working on the climate side. I think the thing that I would like to focus on in this committee is really that sustainable infrastructure. And so, you know, not so much how are we going to combat climate change, but how are we going to combat the effects of climate change? So what kind of changes are we going to make within our physical infrastructure that are going to make it easier for us to bounce back? I had a meeting with somebody from the insurance industry talking about hail-resistant shingles. And so how do we make those more available to consumers so that we're not getting billions of dollars in hail claims every year? And so that's, you know, that's really where I'm hoping that we keep the focus of this committee. So, Representative Franzen?
Well, Madam Chair, we just listened to a presentation, nothing about climate change, which is leading the questions today, so thank you for indulging us. Mr. Kolash, what causes more deaths, would you say? Would you say that it's extreme cold or a subtle rise in surface temperature?
Mr. Kolash?
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, I'm not in a position right now to speculate on that. Again, that would be a question that would be best directed to the Department of Health. Or the Centers for Disease Control on the death rates from various impacts like that.
Well,
And actually, we have a couple other members on the list, too. So did you want to follow up, Representative Franzen? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So the answer would be cold. And have you modeled the excess deaths that would occur in Minnesota if we lost power for 24 to 48 hours in a polar vortex?
Representative Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, that would be, again, a question best directed toward the Department of Commerce of understanding the resiliency of our electric generation sector and the impacts on that. We have not... I'm not aware of that anyone has modeled the potential for excess deaths of a long-term blackout in Minnesota.
I think that's a good question, Representative Thank Branson. You. And that's exactly this is the resiliency piece that we're trying to examine.
Correct. So I have a way of circling back. Madam Chair, I think this is really important information. As we are going after baseload, reliable energy, and putting the stress of solar and wind onto our grid, these are answers that we need to know. Yep. I mean, obviously, today is a cold day. It's been colder. But could you imagine not having heat for 24, 48 hours? I mean, I think we're hardy people. We would be able to survive. But you think about the elderly, mm-hmm. Frail, immunocompromised people that may not be able to survive 24, 48 hours without any heat. And so, Mr. Kolesch, if you could just kind of look at that. I mean, if you're going to talk about climate change and the effects that it has, we need to be talking about the effects that your policies that you're bringing toward our committee will have on the people in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Branson. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair, and to Mr. Kolesch, thanks for being with us this morning. In my community, one of the greatest signs of the Climate Action Plan is the advance of solar panels in agriculture land and property. So my question to you is, how do solar panels impact soil erosion, runoff, and water quality?
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair and Representative, we are looking at that. Certainly we pay attention to the importance of the land that the solar panels are on. We have not heard of any issues about causing problems with soil health. We look at that within the stormwater runoff and making sure that those installations do manage the stormwater appropriately. And what we see with many of the solar panels is they can also plant pollinator-friendly habitat along with the solar panels to protect against erosion, protect the stormwater quality, and also provide co-benefits along with providing the electric generation from the solar panels.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a quick comment and a quick question. Solar panels were mentioned. I drive home on I-94, and there's a lot of solar gardens along the freeway up around St. Cloud. In the last 2 weeks, they've all been covered by snow, and there's nobody out there cleaning the snow off of those, so they have not generated a whole lot of electricity the last month or so. But I, too, am concerned about the grid reliability. But just to switch topics, you mentioned clean transportation. I assume you're talking about electric vehicles. Could you explain to us, are they really clean? Are electric vehicles really clean?
Representative Kolesch. Or Mr. Kolesch, sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, within the clean transportation sector, it is a broad sector that's looking at using cleanest fuels for the internal combustion engines, along with the use of electric vehicles where it makes sense, and on also the opportunities that we have to use other forms of transportation, including public transportation as well, where that makes sense. So that clean transportation is expansive and includes all of the opportunities that we see for reducing the emissions from our transportation sector, including looking at ways that we can achieve emission reductions from the heavy-duty vehicles as well. And I believe Department of Transportation will also be talking about, again, more on the infrastructure side than on the emission reduction side. That would be a discussion we would be very willing to have about the emission reduction side of that. Working forward. As far as the life cycle analysis of electric vehicles and the comparison of those in internal combustion engines, we continue to see the developing science that does show that they, on a wheel-to-well basis, do have lower emissions. We do also look at and starting to look at and working at this with the federal government and with the automobile manufacturers about understanding the entirety of the footprint of an electric vehicle that does include the battery manufacturing, the steel manufacturing that goes into it, the electronics manufacturing, and that those are continuing to show that there are similar to, on par with, if not slightly better than an internal combustion engine. But I don't have access to those reports right now at my fingertips.
Thank you, Mr. Polish. Representative Anderson.
Just a quick one. So you did mention biofuel. So is that a part of the plan going forward, higher blends of ethanol, biodiesel? Is that part of your plan of all of the above?
Mr. Kolesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that is it. Those discussions, a clean fuel standard, the use of biofuels to reduce the emissions is part of the climate action framework.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Schultz?
I'll follow up to that same question. Thank you, Madam Chair. To Mr. Kolesh, as you talk about biofuels, Representative Anderson and I both represent heavy agriculture districts. And as we see the advance of solar panels across Minnesota, that certainly takes away from our ability to even produce the corn that can help or the soybeans that can help with biofuels. So how do you manage both of those desires and further? As you're going about this, what is that impact to the local economies in rural Minnesota?
Mr. Kolesh.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have not yet seen an issue with the number of solar panels competing with the number of acres available for the biofuels. I have not heard about that, seen that. That would be an additional question for Department of Agriculture to look into or to ask the Department of Agriculture as well. We do see that there is plenty of capacity for the inputs to the biofuel production. We do see that biofuel production is important, especially for the economic development and jobs in greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota as an opportunity to continue to advance climate action in Minnesota. And again, it's in the climate action framework. We do view that as an important role to play because it does have importance both for clean jobs, clean economy, and for reducing emissions from the transportation sector.
And I think that just really demonstrates how interconnected all of this is. Representative Schultz, did you have any follow-up?
Yeah, my follow-up to that, Madam Chair, thank you. And to Mr. Kolesh, what would you say the definition of homegrown energy is here in Minnesota, recognizing these competing interests and where we're going to get this homegrown energy, as you suggest?
Mr. Kolesh.
Madam Chair, Representative, when we're looking at that's a colloquial term that I've used, homegrown, but mostly that we are looking at the kinds of energy that we are generating within our borders and our boundaries. So if we are able to generate electricity through the use of solar panels or wind turbines, or we're able to produce a fuel through biofuel production, or we're able to replace natural gas with a biogas or a renewable natural gas that we're able to produce within Minnesota, then that is a benefit to us because we're creating more clean economy, more clean jobs by generating our energy sources and not having to import them from other states or from other countries.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to comment on that and just say that I think that these are very significant and weighty discussions to have as you consider homegrown energy and the amount of land and property that it takes to produce biofuels, while at the same time you're limiting you know, a lot of that land with the advance of this energy. And further, as a part of that, one of the points in your presentation here talked about green spaces, and there's actually multiple pictures shown here that show rural communities how our green spaces are then taken up by solar panels and by wind turbines. Please tell us how that is the advance of green space in rural communities.
Mr. Kolesh.
Madam Chair, Representative, I want to emphasize that when we look at building climate resiliency in communities, the importance is that the communities are involved and that they have the roles, they have the tools available to them, they have the resources available to them to make the decisions and then take action on the plans and their desires. So there's no requirement within the state climate action framework to that a city take action like you were describing, where we're removing green space with turbines or solar panels. It is providing the resources, both the financial resources and the technical resources to enable our communities, our local governments, and the tribal nations that we share the geography with to make their decisions about what they need to do to continue to provide critical services to the residents that they serve as we see a changing climate, a warmer and wetter Minnesota.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Kolish, in response to that, I would simply suggest that a county bordering my district is being turned from being a largely agricultural county and community to pushing the narrative almost 50% solar gardens over the next 10 years. And I would suggest to you that actually is happening because of the subsidies from federal and state action that is forcing our farmers to not even be able to compete, which will threaten the future food security of our state, of our nation, and of the world. And that's a big concern that that I will be working on throughout my time here in the House. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, I came here a bit late. I didn't expect to deal with the icy roads. I used to work at the Ordway years ago, and I remember dealing with the cold and the snow, but I don't remember dealing with ice rinks when I would drive to work. And I just want to mention, and I know Representative Mary Franson brought this up, but the people in the disability community are the people who will be impacted by climate change in ways that I don't think many of us realize. When I woke up this morning, one of the first things I saw on social media was that Metro Mobility and Transit Link Rider Alert said due to icy road conditions, all bus service has been suspended. Bus service will resume when it is safe to do so. And then driving in here today, I heard that the light rail transit was working, but and rapid bus transit was working. So I was happy to see that. But I do think we do, at this table, we need to think about people in the disability community when we're looking at climate change, because it will affect people who are low income, people who are disabled. And I want to center our focus on people who are not at the table. So I appreciate you bringing that conversation to this table.
Thank you, Representative Ream. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Assistant Commissioner, for that presentation. There's been a lot of questions with hypotheticals and some good things to think about as we're thinking about climate change. But I do want to deal with the reality of something that happened or is happening today. Obviously, it's very icy outside, but also there is an air quality alert that is in the red for the Twin Cities, meaning that it is dangerous for everyone, and especially dangerous for those with things like respiratory diseases or have perhaps suffered with COVID in the last couple of years, perhaps have asthma, other things. So we're seeing the effects of climate change already, and they're extremely dangerous. I just want to say thank you for your work on this, and maybe toss an easy softball here and ask, do you think many of the things you're recommending to us will help with some dangerous things like continually poor air quality? We see an alert here, the worst we've had since 2005. Will the work you're doing help our air quality?
Mr. Kolesh.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it will. Because we do focus on both within the framework of reducing emissions, building resiliency, and addressing equity. We also know that there are co-benefits. So we are looking at the importance of climate change and the ability to improve air quality. That can come from as we reduce the combustion of fossil fuels and switch to cleaner fuels or to electrification where possible, then that means less emissions coming from multiple sources, whether that's from a motor vehicle or from an industrial facility or from buildings that are using a fossil fuel to heat the building. And there are other sources that are cleaner and have lower emissions. We also understand the need to address climate change in partnership at a federal level and a global level, because in 2022, when we had the, or sorry, 2021, when we had an extended air quality alert issue due to fires that were happening in Canada and on the West Coast, and we continue to see that happening, and we do see that those impacts are from climate change on those wildfires and forest fires, and that does have an impact. So we need collective action to address climate change so that we are able to improve air quality, particularly focusing on services and improvement in air quality for those who are most vulnerable to air quality, as you mentioned, and ensure that they are seeing benefits to this work going forward.
All right, we have Representative Akam on this, and then we are at our scheduled time for this. So Representative Akam, and then very quickly. Okay, and then we'll go to Representative Franson, and then MnDOT can come up and give their presentation. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and my apologies for being late. I also was stuck in icy roads, and so really appreciated the comment by Representative Ream about the disability community and the impact by shutting down Metro Transit this morning, or Metro Mobility. My husband lives with a disability and relies on Metro Mobility for transportation needs, and so certainly appreciate the attention being brought to the disabled community. My question is real quick to the commissioner. I know that MPCA will be coming up with their emissions inventory soon, wondering, and if I missed this, I apologize for not being here. I will go back and watch the presentation. When do you expect to have the emissions inventory for Minnesota ready?
Mr. Kolesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Akam, we plan to have that report released by January 31st of this year.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Representative Franson, real quick.
Thank you. Speaking of the icy road, so the summary of climate actions, if we follow everything in this book, will there will icy roads be a thing of the past?
I don't think icy roads will ever be a thing of the past in Minnesota.
We're making a big deal about the icy roads that I've grown up with, icy roads. You know,
right.
It's not a new thing.
No.
We act today like it's never happened before. So if we do this, we're going to stop talking about icy roads.
I think the goal is to minimize the impacts of weather and climate. And so, we're never going to get to, perfect 75 degrees and sunny every day here in Minnesota. And that would be a problem. And so anything that we do is really to minimize and so that icy road conditions or 107 degree days in the summer don't become our normal. And so I don't think we can ever guarantee with certainty that something is or isn't going to happen. So thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kolesch. And MnDOT, if you could make your way to the table. So the next item on our agenda is a presentation by Amber Dolman from the Minnesota Department of Transportation's Office of Sustainability and Public Health. Ms. Dolman, please introduce yourself for the record and begin with your testimony. And we also will have Eric Rudin here for questions if we need any. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for braving the icy roads.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is Amber Dolman. I am the office director for MnDOT's Sustainability and Public Health work. And just to quickly recap, some of the things that I'll be touching on today do directly fit into the climate action framework that our colleagues at the Pollution Control Agency discussed and talked about. Specifically, just to mention or reference a few, a lot of our work is looking at how we can create more opportunities for people to be able to walk, bike, use transit, and possibly telecommute, especially when there might be adverse weather events, as discussed earlier. We're looking at how we may maximize resiliency and greenhouse gas mitigation in our infrastructure projects at MnDOT. And we're also looking at increasing the use of clean fuels, including lower carbon biofuels that were discussed, and expanding our electric vehicle charging infrastructure and improving our overall vehicle efficiency and emission standards. So those are some of the things that are related to Pollution Control Agency's Climate Action Framework. And I'll get into a little bit more of our work in sustainability and public health. So a lot of the focus of the work in our Sustainable Public Health Office includes how we're reducing carbon pollution from transportation. Some of the things have been mentioned or referenced earlier, including electric vehicles, cleaner fuels, carbon reduction program. And we have our Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council, which makes recommendations to our commissioner on how we may reduce carbon as a state. And I'll be talking a little bit more about some of our federal programs, which you all heard about last week in your committee. We're also leading by example and looking at how we can make our operations more efficient as an agency, including how we might be able to achieve some of our sustainability targets with the work that we're doing in terms of our overall fleet and in terms of how we administer and maintain and operate our overall system. We also have our transportation and public health work, which is where we include our complete streets policy and implementing that policy work. We went through recently an update to that policy and are looking at how we may train staff internally and how we will continue to implement that policy overall and looking at how we use our current infrastructure and system. And then we're also focusing on transportation system resilience. So what sort of research we may be able to continue to advance to understand how to make our system more resilient in the future and currently, and then looking at how our bridges and culverts can continue to function properly as the climate changes. And I'll talk a little bit more about the Federal Resilient Program coming up. And then lastly, we have worked with strategic partnerships where we're working with some of our other agency partners and external stakeholders and partners as well about how we might use our right-of-way differently and how we may think creatively about the uses of our overall right-of-way. So I mentioned that I was going to discuss three of the new federal programs that our office is looking at implementing, the first one being our National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, which has provided Minnesota, this is a formula program, and provided MnDOT with $68 million over the course of 5 years, so just a little under $20 million a year. And we have submitted a plan to Federal Highway Administration that identifies our initial phase of corridor, alternative fuel corridors that we'll be implementing infrastructure on, where we're looking at spacing out charging stations from 50 miles along I-35 and I-94 in the state. And we're hoping to put out a request for proposals this spring, which we'll be looking at where we would site some of those and implement them. Also to note about this particular program is that there is a competitive grant portion of this. They have not released that request for proposals, but this is something that our local communities would be eligible for, provided they're prepared to submit and develop those applications. On the next slide, I'll kind of show where the overall the infrastructure is and kind of reiterating those alternative fuel corridors that we'll be beginning our electric vehicle infrastructure build out with. And just note that these are chargers that will be along 94 and 35, and in some of those darker clusters you can kind of see are the spaces that we would be looking to identify or get proposals for on siting electric vehicle chargers. Okay, so our next program is the Carbon Reduction Program. And the purpose of this program is something that you were all discussing and hearing a little bit more about from Pollution Control Agency earlier, where we're looking to reduce transportation emissions in our overall system. So some of the things that we're currently working on, there are many eligible different project types within this program, including how we may advance transportation and mitigate congestion and manage congestion overall, how we might look at efficient lighting and traffic control, and how we may increase other options. So people have other options when perhaps one transportation option is unavailable. They may be able to adapt a little bit more easily to other options within their own community to get to where they need to be. So this program gets approximately $20.5 million a year to MnDOT, and it's a formula program as well. And in the next this next year, we'll be working with some of our partners and stakeholders to develop a plan that will need to be submitted to Federal Highways and USDOT on what our priorities are going to be for the program overall. The thing that I'll also point out about this program is that it does have some appropriations specific to targets and geography, which is on the next slide, and it includes distributing some of those funds based on population. And many of those funds are then going to go to our partners at the Metropolitan Planning Organization areas within the state. There are 8 of them. One of them includes the Metropolitan Council, and then the other areas that receive these fundings are the Fargo-Moorhead area, Rochester, Duluth, St. Cloud, La Crosse, La Crescent, Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, and Mankato. So there are some of these sub-allocation targets that we'll be looking at distributing, and those MPOs will be working with us and identifying the priorities that they would like to see in terms of distributing those funds, which can also include things like electric buses or increased public transportation access. The last program that we have is our PROTECT Formula Program. And PROTECT is a pretty lengthy acronym. I think what's important for you all to remember is that this is the resilience piece of the federal programs that we have being distributed to the Department of Transportation. And it's going to provide fundings to help make our surface transportation system more resilient to some of the natural hazards that we see in a changing climate. We are going to receive approximately $23 million annually over the next 5 years. And we'll, in receiving those funds, some of them must be used for planning activities, so how we're going to prioritize and what we would like to prioritize the use of those funds for. So we're having some internal conversations about what that looks like for the early years of the programs and how we'll be able to work it in some, into some of the existing projects that we have to make them more resilient. And so we're looking at things like culverts. We're also looking at things like living snow fences or other types of snow fences to help us maintain our roadways more easily in the winter months. And then some of these funds may be used for new capacity or constructing new capacity, and we may also use some of these funds for developing different phases of projects. So there are a handful of different eligible project types within our PROTECT program. As I mentioned earlier, some of these are related to planning and how we're going to plan for more resilient projects. And then some of them are related to actually implementing some of the infrastructure improvements. So this is another one of the federal programs that does have some discretionary grant programs. They have not released that grant program yet, but this is something that communities will be eligible for applying along with tribal partners to those competitive grant programs. And we are anticipating that that program will be released sometime later, or later this winter or early spring. So that gets us to the portion of, we have a handful of things that are going on within sustainability and public health. And as these programs get stood up and as our office is continuing to advance work around sustainability and public health, what are some of the gaps or opportunities that we see as an office? And some of the things to bring to your attention, and I think you all have discussed this as a committee, is that federal funds often require local match. So the federal government will provide 80% of the funding, and then we are to find and identify a 20% non-federal match to these programs. And that includes our electric vehicle infrastructure, as well as the carbon reduction program and the PROTECT programs. The other thing to understand and discuss or that we're kind of working with partners through is that when it comes to the electric vehicle infrastructure charging, we're currently statutorily only allowed to site those chargers within MnDOT Trunk Highway right-of-way. And so we need to look at how we might have a little more flexibility in working with some of our private sector partners or some of our local partners on siting those charging stations in different spaces. The other thing to note is that with some of these new programs, we have different levels of staff capacity to stand them up and making sure that people are able to carry out and implement some of these federal programs and funds overall. So we are looking at how we our staff capacity and skills to implementing them. And then at the very beginning, I mentioned our Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council. This council is a group of partners, external partners and stakeholders from a range of communities and perspectives, including a lot of our businesses throughout the state who make recommendations to MnDOT about how to reduce carbon emissions. And that committee sometimes makes recommendations that go beyond some of MnDOT's purview and looking at how we might implement or support reduced or biofuels, for example, or including clean fuels legislation. And then also how land use may impact transportation and what that looks like. And that's not within MnDOT's purview in terms of what we're looking at. So those are some of the things that council makes recommendations to MnDOT on that come from a range of partners that we'll be looking at how we implement and address. And with that, those are the things that we're briefly working on. And I will take questions.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the Ms. Dahlman, this presentation. You know, transportation is the number one source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state and growing globally and nationally, and so I appreciate this a lot. Madam Chair, I you know, there's a different handout that talks about sub-initiatives and state action steps. And I was looking through that on transportation, so I have a couple questions on that. Would it be appropriate to reference that? Okay, and I'm sure you're familiar with that document, right? So goal one, and just members, I'm looking at this handout, summary of climate actions for Minnesota's climate action framework that's in the packet. And so goal one is clean transportation, and I like, you know, a lot of these policies. Mr. Marvel, spoiler alert, you might see a number of these in the transportation bill. Surprise, surprise. But you have three categories here besides these policies, state action steps: lead, enact, and encourage. And you have a definition at the front of this document about what lead, enact, and encourage means. And, you know, I was struck by the fact that the one enact you have, and enact is our job, you know, that seems to be a legislative function here. You have the clean fuel standard as the one thing you're delegating to us. Although, you know, a number of these have been in legislation before, and as I said, we'll have hopefully in our bill this year. And, you know, one, for example, the Twin Cities to Milwaukee rail project was something we did enact in the transportation bill in 2021. So because I think ultimately the goal here is some legislative engagement, I would love to hear, you know, why only you have one check mark by or one policy of an enact check mark by, and do you see, you know, other items in state action steps in addition to a clean fuel standard as part of what you would like to see the legislature take on?
Ms. Thalman?
Madam Chair, Representative, the Climate Action Framework, it's my understanding, was developed as a subcabinet of the governor's office, and with participation from many of the state agencies. I am not familiar enough to be able to speak at this time about what additional items we may look at enacting or seeking support from the legislature on, and we'll ask.
Mr. Rudin, if you'd like to identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Eric Rudin with MnDOT Government Affairs. And, I think, you know, there are certainly items here that, even though they may not require a change in state statute, might benefit from a change in state statute, and Mr. Chair, you pointed out a few of those. So I think we can maybe talk with the MPCA, since they really led the effort to develop this this framework, and see if we can identify a few of those that again, while they may not necessarily require a change in state law to implement, you know, could benefit from higher visibility and direction to agencies and local governments and other partners by implementing a change in state statute.
Okay, so thank you. That's very helpful, Mr. Dean. So basically this is really an act as something you've identified that absolutely requires a change.
I think that's correct. And Mr. Okay. Kolash is nodding his head in agreement. Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we have. Oh. I mean, one quick follow-up.
Sure. Representative
Horn. Then the last one is, you know, I was pleased that you included land use, several different action steps on land use, because, you know, this is just sort of an under-reported aspect of reducing greenhouse gases in the transportation sector, which is report after report, including a legislatively mandated report a while back now, I think over a decade ago, on how to reduce greenhouse gases in the transportation sector, really identified three major things: land use, encouragement of additional public transit, bike, walk infrastructure, which you pay a lot of attention to here, as well as electric vehicles and fuels. But land use is the one that we get the biggest bang for our buck and is really very rarely talked about. So if you could just amplify a little bit on this under sub-initiative 1.1.1, you have promote land use planning that supports multimodal transportation projects, and then you have an entire sub-initiative 1.1.2, plan land use that supports multimodal transportation. If you could maybe discuss this in a little more detail now, or if you're not ready to, we could talk about it at a different time, but just your thoughts on that.
Ms. Dahlman?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question on land use. As I referenced earlier, land use is an area that certainly has a large impact on transportation and is not within MnDOT's purview. We do work with local communities and counties on when they're looking at transportation projects, and they provide us with information about how it impacts their overall land use. We are a willing partner in discussions with our regional planning organizations and some of our metropolitan planning organizations as well about the use of land use and impacts on the transportation system.
Thanks. Maybe it's something we can talk to the Met Council.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And we have two members on the list, then we're going to move on to the Department of Administration. So first on the list is, so this is really funny, every time I see this, Smith and Anderson. Now I'm just thinking about the Matrix. Representative Smith.
Agent Smith. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a sort of a three-pronged question here that I'll ask as it goes on. First question is getting back to specifically the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. You mentioned some things. Could you talk a little bit about the parameters about where those charging stations need to be? What are the parameters? Do they have to be on interstates? Can they be on state highways?
Ms. Dahlman?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. So our first phase of this particular program identifies two alternative fuel corridors, I-35 and 94. And in terms of building out the infrastructure for this particular program, we're supposed to site the charging stations within 1 mile of those corridors and within 50 mile increments. So there should be a charging station approximately every 50 miles along the corridors within 1 mile of 94.
Representative Smith?
Just to follow up, those parameters, is that from the federal government? Is that from the governor's office? Where are those directing you towards those specifically?
Ms. Dahlman?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it's within the federal guidance for the program.
Okay, that's very helpful. My just follow up, this may be more of a comment, is I know since it's federal, we don't have wiggle room there. I would say the third largest city in Minnesota, as well as the city that houses the largest private employer in the state, Rochester, where I represent, we are not close to any of those. And would just, like consideration as we expand that program later on. And I know fellow representatives from the Winona area or the Minnesota side of the La Crosse metropolitan area would also really like some more coverage for southeastern Minnesota. So not really a question, but maybe I'll answer a question of when could we see more coverage in those areas.
Ms. Dahlman?
Madam Chair, Representative, good question. And it made me realize I should clarify. The two alternative fuel corridors that we identified for phase one are 35 and 94. For later years of the program, we need to identify additional alternative fuel corridors, which you can kind of see in the gray area here are highlighted as opportunities or possibilities. So that's one thing. As we continue to work with our partners and stakeholders in identifying appropriate corridors, we'll figure out which phases will build out additional alternative fuel corridors. And then the second comment or response to that question is that there is a discretionary grant program for this particular federal program. It has not been released yet, but this is something that local communities and partners can apply for.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we will go on to Representative Anderson, if you could. We are running short on time for this, so thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And that was kind of my line of questioning, too, about these charging stations. And since in Minnesota only certain entities can actually sell electricity, will these be free, or is MnDOT going to be selling electricity, or how are you going to handle that?
Ms. Dahlman.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. At this time, that's something that we're continuing to work through, especially considering where the charging stations may be sited and who takes overall maintenance and operations, takes over the responsibility of overall maintenance and operations of them.
Madam Chair, if I could just jump in there, too.
Mr. Dean.
Thank you. MnDOT does not want to sell electricity, or we don't even want to own or operate these charging stations, so we really are looking to partner with the private sector to hopefully, as Ms. Dolman mentioned, we will have a legislative initiative this year that will allow us to do that, to use the federal funds, the state matching funds, to construct them on private property, you know, enter into agreements with private companies to maintain them and operate them long term. But yes, MnDOT does not actually want to get into this business, so we're looking to private to do a public private partnership.
Any follow up, Representative Anderson?
No.
Okay, Representative Schultz, real quick, please.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Representative Smith's question. For the whole of the state, you know, this appears to be a priority of some on this committee. And to that point, my question for MnDOT is, do you have an estimated number on the cost to the state or to the investment as the whole, from the federal, state, local, private investment, to have electric charging stations within 20 miles of any Minnesota resident?
Ms. Thalman?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. At this time, we're working through the federal funds that we have available to us, and phase one that we've identified, those initial alternative fuel corridors. We'll be working with our partners and communities to identify additional alternative fuel corridors for the years of funding that we have for the program. And it's possible that local communities may have interest or in applying for some of the discretionary program funds as well to increase the prevalence of those charging stations. So I don't have a cost to build out for 20 miles for each resident at hand. I only can share the amount of federal funds we currently have available to us and the amount of how much it costs for a charging station of 4 chargers at one time that we're anticipating for this particular.
Thank you guys very much. Unfortunately, we're going to have to move on to the Department of Administration. So our agendas, there's an overview by Marcus Grubbs from the Department of Administration's Office of Enterprise Sustainability. Mr. Grubbs, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and begin with your presentation, please.
Yeah, of course. Good morning. Madam Chair and Representatives, my name is Marcus Grubbs, and I'm the Director of the Office of Enterprise Sustainability at the Department of Administration. And thank you for inviting me to speak with you this morning. I don't have a PowerPoint deck because we have such a short time today. I'm excited to be here and share with you about the enterprise sustainability effort and some of the accomplishments, opportunities, and challenges that we face. So I've provided a handout, which is a scorecard and executive summary of our last report. I'll be referencing that from time to time. I think everyone's got it up. It should look like this. So first, some background on the enterprise sustainability effort. Work by agencies to develop the effort began in 2016. Through a results-based accountability planning process, 6 goals were identified. Those goals you can see on the handout, but they're about reducing fossil fuel use in our fleet, reducing our energy use per square foot in our building and facilities, reducing our water consumption, increasing our sustainable purchasing, and increasing the diversion of our waste to recycling and organics, and also reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. You can see the goals on the handout. These goals are focused on reducing the environmental footprint of state operations. So our my colleagues today have testified about programs and work they do with others, and this is specifically focused on our state operations. And so it's focused on reducing our environmental footprint, but also avoiding operating costs. So in addition to the goals, structures for how the agencies engage in sustainability and with each other was created. The goals, the sustainability engagement structure, and the role of our office, the Office of Enterprise Sustainability at ADMIN, were detailed in Executive Order 17-12, signed by former Governor Dayton in April 2017, and then reaffirmed by Governor Walz in 2019 in Executive Order 19-27. Some key elements of the sustainability engagement structure. We have a steering team consisting of 8 commissioners from 5 core agencies, the Department of Admin, Natural Resource, Commerce, Pollution Control, and Transportation, and three rotating members. Those rotating members are currently Chair Zelli from the Metropolitan Council, the Department of Human Services, and Corrections. The executive order requires participation of all cabinet-level agencies. So those cabinet-level agencies, the 23 of them, and then also the Metropolitan Council participates voluntarily. They're required to participate in annual reporting of sustainability data related to these goals specifically, participate in interagency work groups. They're required to do annual planning around sustainability for their own operations, and also to take actions towards achieving the goals. Additionally, each agency has identified a sustainability coordinator to be their principal team member responsible for advancing sustainability in their agency. Some of our agencies, the larger ones, for example, Department of Corrections, may have a full-time sustainability coordinator, and our much smaller agencies, for example, the Bureau of Mediation Services, it might just be a few hours of somebody's time. The Office of Enterprise Sustainability, so we often abbreviate as OES, if I slip into that, I apologize, was created to manage the annual tracking and reporting of sustainability data, the publication of annual updates, share best practices, and provide technical assistance to agencies and local governments. The scorecard is an example of that reporting. And you can see more at sustainability.mn.gov, where we have a very comprehensive report for ourselves as an enterprise and then also each agency. The engagement structure that we have is truly unique among state governments, but was developed by examining the best practices in the private sector. So this mirrors largely what Cargill, Best Buy, Target, 3M, Ecolab, what they're all doing. And so it's a sort of a spoke, it's a hub and spoke type of model. We are frequently asked by other states to share our experience as they are developing their own internal sustainability programs, and it's frequently lauded as one of the most well-structured programs in the country. So next, I want to share a bit about our role specifically and what we do. Reporting is one of our primary responsibilities that I've talked about, and we achieve this through our website at sustainability.mn.gov. I encourage you to take a few minutes to browse the site. There are some dynamic visualizations. They're very fun and informative. There we publish the progress towards goals of the enterprise and also for each agency that participates. Many people at each agency assist in the reporting process to aggregate utility data in our sustainability reporting tool, which is sort of the back end to our site, and then it gets published once a year to our website. OES also facilitates interagency work groups where we focus on sharing best practices amongst each other and then bringing in experts to share best practices with agencies. We also provide technical assistance to agencies, and so I'm just going to talk about that a little. There's a lot more. So some of the tools that we use to assist agencies include our umbrella contracts. So working with the Office of State Procurement, we have contracts for things like evaluating buildings for energy efficiency, solar design build, electric vehicle supply equipment, solid waste assessments, organics recycling bags for bins, all of these tiny hurdles that make these practices difficult we try to solve for our agencies. We may also provide analysis on simple projects around energy efficiency and renewable energy. We work with agencies and the Department of Admin Division of Real Estate and Construction on our green lease program to improve the sustainability of spaces leased by agencies, so spaces we lease from the private sector. We currently operate the State Building Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund, where agencies can finance energy efficiency projects with a short payback. I'll say right now the projects we're seeing come through are almost exclusively LED light bulbs. And they have a very short payback. 1.9 years is the last project I saw. The 2020 legislature also authorized $2 million in appropriation bonds for the Department of Administration to fund installation of electric vehicle charging equipment at facilities owned by state agencies, and we're currently working to distribute those resources. We also provide technical assistance to local governments. In our early days, local governments frequently reached out for technical assistance in developing their own sustainability efforts and goals. They have also used some of our umbrella contracts, such as the solar design build contract and the electric vehicle charging equipment. We also work very closely with our partners at PCA and Commerce as their work intersects with this a lot. Lastly, I'll talk about our current progress towards goals and what we see as opportunities and challenges. In the area of fleet, you'll see that we've achieved a fossil fuel reduction of nearly 16%. That's about 50% progress towards our goal. We've seen lasting reductions in fleet fossil fuel use in our light fleet, specifically by adopting hybrid vehicles, plug-in hybrids, and electrics. However, long-term, to achieve our 30% reduction goal, we need to see reductions in our heavy and medium fleets, and so that includes 11 million gallons or so at Metropolitan Transit and more at MnDOT for their snowplows. And that's a much more challenging project, and the solutions for those are not quite in the market. But you can look towards, for example, the Metropolitan Transit zero emission bus plan as a strategy that's going to be used to reduce our fossil fuel emissions there. Energy efficiency is an area where we've been pretty successful. So some agencies, including the Minnesota Department of Administration, have reduced their energy consumption per square foot by 30%. So on this capital complex, we've reduced our energy use by 30%. And it also creates substantial avoided operating costs and mitigates rising utility rates. That's the important part. So those avoided costs might be from not paying additional costs for rising utility rates. We also see agencies like the Department of Corrections in the last year did an assessment for their Faribault facility, which is over 1 million square feet, and plans to assess for energy efficiency the remaining portfolio, about 6 million square feet, which is a lot of work because they have to walk through every single square foot of it. And then in the area of GHG emissions, you'll see we've achieved a 30% GHG emission reduction goal. Our emissions come primarily from our buildings, our fleet, those areas where we've actually seen real reductions is largely from the greening of the electric grid and also through energy efficiency. And so we look to that as where we can accelerate GHG emissions, more efficiency, more fossil fuel reduction, but realistically long-term to achieve goals that are laid out in the Next Gen Energy Act, we're looking at how do we address the more stubborn emissions, which are heating fuels in our buildings, and backup fuels like diesel and propane and fuel oil. So I just want to say thanks for the time, and I'll take any questions that you have.
Thank you. I'm going to give us just a few minutes for questions because we are kind of running up against time, and then we'll have Met Council go next, and then DPS can wrap us up. So Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation. The scorecard is really helpful visual to see some of the good work that you're doing. And at the end, you kind of touched on my question, and it's around building energy efficiency. And in Minnesota, 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from buildings. The stubborn heating and cooling is a large part of that. And so I didn't see that necessarily in that granular level within this data. And so wondering, are there goals that you have that you're trying to achieve as far as energy efficiency reductions within buildings, within the state's owned buildings, I guess?
Yeah.
Mr. Grubbs?
Yeah, Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We are targeting a 30% energy efficiency improvement or a 30% energy efficiency reduction. And I think that that is the overarching goal. However, it comes from a bunch of places, including buildings, including wastewater treatment plants, where there are lots of opportunities across the enterprise. Each agency has worked to develop their own targets with us under Executive Order 19-25, I'm hoping I'm quoting that correctly. And so we can provide more information, but different agencies have different abilities. Admin, for example, we've achieved about 30%. It's difficult for us to achieve more efficiency. It gets more and more costly. Other agencies that haven't achieved efficiency gains to date maybe have lower hanging fruit.
Brief follow-up. Thank you. And so you had said in most of the agencies, their revolving loan fund requests for energy efficiency have been around LED light bulbs. And so while that's great, kind of low-hanging fruit, and so hoping that with the opportunities we have with some of the federal programs and the incentives that we could be thinking about things like heat pumps that can address some of that heating and cooling. And so just hope that there's a little nudge in the direction beyond just light bulbs.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Grubbs. So I'm interested in the comments you made about support you provide to local governments. Can you talk about that, how that fits in your charter, and how much of that you're seeing?
Yeah,
Mr. Grubbs.
Madam Chair, Representative Kraft, thank you for the question. You know, maybe 5 years ago, we saw a lot of calls from local government to ask us for technical assistance, specifically around goal setting or the use of our contracts that we've established. It has waned, but we still work with folks who may ask us to come out and give a presentation around energy efficiency. I think that it's something that we're ready and capable to do when they come and ask. It's not something we're proactively doing.
Okay. And do you think some of that goes then because of the Green Step Cities program? That's something that a lot of the locals are more, Mr. Grubbs?
Yeah, absolutely, Madam Chair. We work with our partners over at Green Step Cities and Commerce and anyone else who's providing technical assistance to local governments. And so, for example, we'll share best practices amongst each other so we're not duplicating work, so we can distribute material to local governments without having to all generate it ourselves, for example.
Representative Anderson, and I'll get the last question, and then we will move on to my council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grubbs, you mentioned when the state replaces its fleet, you mentioned electric and hybrid vehicles. I would hope there's also the use of flex fuel vehicles. What percentage of the fleet, when you replace vehicles, do you try to attempt to get flex fuel vehicles?
Mr. Grubbs?
Yeah. So fleet purchasing is directed under statute, and I am not going to get the number correctly, but I'll direct that specific number to our fleet and surplus services. For the admin-owned fleet that they lease to other agents, sorry, Madam Chair and Representative, admin owns and leases a fleet to some agencies while other agencies own their own fleet, for example, MnDOT, DPS, and DNR. And so we'll have to direct that question to each of those.
I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your presentation. Next up, we have the Metropolitan Council, and we will have a presentation by Lisa Barajas. I'm horrible. From the Metropolitan Council. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas, not your typical Minnesota last name, so I totally understand. I'm the Executive Director of Community Development at the Metropolitan Council and am the executive sponsor for the Council's climate work across all of our divisions. Today I want to talk a little bit about some of the work we're doing, and in the interest of time, you might hear me talk very speedily. We've been doing a lot of work for a number of years around a number of items that you've been hearing about from the other agencies today that are really focused on maintaining our own infrastructure, being good stewards for the investments that the region has already made in the significant amount of regional infrastructure that we already have. This is 15 plus years worth of work summarized on a slide with some links, so I know I could talk about each one of these things ad nauseum on any given time period, and certainly we have experts across our council agency who have led each of these initiatives. Some of these are very internally focused, and I just want to touch on the top one about our climate vulnerability assessment, which really is gets to that sustainable infrastructure that Chair Cagle was talking about today. The importance of the impacts that we're facing today in this region and how they impact the infrastructure and the facilities and the buildings and the houses that the council owns across this region. It's not just the light rail line. It's not just the wastewater treatment plant, but all of the buildings and facilities that house our staff, the garages and maintenance facilities for our transit, and the 150 housing units that we own across the region as well, where we are housing low-income families, are all important and are all part of this. So we have taken the time to both assess those impacts today that we're seeing on the ground, which are primarily related to more water on the landscape and flooding on a more frequent basis, not just in the river corridors, but across the landscape and standing waters, as well as extended and extreme heat events that cause buckling and stress on our systems across the board. As an owner and operator of these systems, it's imperative to us that we can provide the reliability and the services and operations that we are responsible for, as well as maintain the infrastructure and avoid some significant insurance claims and costs that we know can happen with significant impacts. So just a number of actions on our, or I'm sorry, activities that are on this slide here today that range from both our internal vulnerability assessments and application to that in our everyday operations, as well as technical assistance that and tools that we provide for local governments around greenhouse gas emissions tracking, support for local government decision making and ordinances and planning tools for solar installations or where they don't want solar installations, to supporting tree canopy work and assessing how that impacts the local government or a local community and where they may choose to prioritize canopy work. And which I know many of you are familiar with and the legislature has directed us to do is also develop a zero emissions bus transition plan, which is work that we completed and is also folded into this work. But today I want to talk about the work that the council has done and recently adopted as our own climate action work plan, which is our agency's plan to both drive down our own operational emissions, reduce and improve our energy efficiency, but also make our infrastructure, our assets and facilities resilient to the impacts that we're facing today. This work dovetails with the work that Assistant Commissioner Kolesch talked to you about earlier today, but is in much level of detail for the Metropolitan Council about which divisions are responsible for which actions and our expectations for coordinating across our agency to do this work. But as I mentioned, we already are seeing these impacts today and have needed to make on the ground changes in our operations, reinvestments in our different infrastructures and facilities, and on an annual basis are always looking at how spring floods are going to impact the delivery of our services as well. As a large wastewater treatment plant provider and as a large transit provider, we purchase electricity is the biggest emissions portion of our portfolio and is where we really focus our climate action planning on our operational side of where we can drive down emissions through our purchase electricity. You can see a large portion of that is in wastewater treatment and where our environmental services staff have been working for more than 10 years on process improvements, building and facility efficiency programs, and looking at other sources and other improvements that they can make to really drive down the amount of electricity that we're going to be needing in order to serve the 150-plus communities in the metro area with wastewater service. And mobile combustion, as we talked about earlier, is the other portion of our emissions profile at the council that is important to us and where we are really looking at improving the efficiency emissions reductions within the fleets that we own, and that's obviously primarily in transit but also in our metro mobility fleet as well, which includes a number of bigger buses or mid-sized buses that need to meet mobility needs, and where we are also currently working on a similar zero emissions bus transition plan for our metro mobility fleet as well. As I mentioned before, this climate action work plan of the council's dovetails with the climate action framework and is specific to the council's work. It is a five-year time frame that we've adopted as part of this and is really internally focused to our work, recognizing that we have a long-range planning and an external focus in our work, that putting out transit, that serving wastewater obviously serves all the local governments within our region and that we have that interaction, but we're really trying to do both, getting our own house in order and leading by example, as well as partnering with others in the region to meet and discuss how we meet regional goals. Our plan is organized by commitments and then strategies and actions associated, but at a high level here, it's just these five commitments, which I say sounds like just, but they're very large and they really drive our work. We're really focusing on these environmental justice principles and ensuring that our impacts are not burdened by to just one community in this region, recognizing that some communities already bear the brunt of impacts today, and decisions in the past that have been made in this region around where roads have been put, where infrastructure has been placed, and also are subject to air quality or mobility issues that we need to be keeping in mind and also addressing and rectifying as we are making decisions moving forward. But as I mentioned before, that we are committed to accelerating our own emissions reductions from our operations and achieving carbon neutrality, that we will also accelerate those reductions through our existing partnerships, through which we have many, but also new partnerships, and being open to exploring and crowdsourcing those ideas with our partners in the region. We also, our commitment for really speaks to the resiliency of the facilities and infrastructure that we own, and being attuned to that and on top of how we plan for those impacts today. And then finally, that we are, commitment five really looks toward our long-range planning efforts in collaboration and partners to really advance regional climate adaptation efforts and planning efforts in this region, especially as we embark on our 2050 planning process. So our upcoming work really is to get down and roll up our sleeves and get to action. We've got a lot of work underway right now that's cross-divisional, ranging from folks all the way from our operating divisions in transit and wastewater services, as well as our folks who run our houses, as well as the folks who are in our insurance and claims risk offices to help organize our work, and that we're doing this work together, learning from one another in our agency and creating shared learnings and approaches to this work across all of the areas of responsibility that we have. As I mentioned before, we're also turning to our 2050 long-range planning work, where we know and we've heard from local governments, from advocacy groups and nonprofits in this region, how important it is that we are talking about climate impacts today that we're facing, and turning our long-range, our land use planning toward what that means for this work going forward, because that's a core function of what the Metropolitan Council is responsible for. And, of course, we continue to support local governments in their own climate action work with the tools and resources that we already provide, and also looking to them for what else they would like us to provide to support their local work as well. And I just gave a very quick run around of all of the work that we do at the council. Happy to return at any time with colleagues who are experts in each of these areas as well, and stand for any questions.
And I'm going to ask members to follow up offline with you just so that we can. I just want to thank everybody. We're going to go just 5 minutes over so we can squeeze in DPS. If any members have any questions or would like Met Council to come back, we can do that. But if we can move on to DPS and wrap up this committee hearing, then that would be wonderful. Thank you so much. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Reed. He will give a short presentation on what the Department of Public Safety is doing around resiliency. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Chair members, thank you for this time. I'll be really brief. My name is Kevin Reed. I'm the interim director for Minnesota Homeland Security Emergency Management. And really, we have two roles when it comes to sustainability and mitigation throughout the state. And I'll just touch briefly on both those. The first one is post-disaster mitigation, is where we can then rebuild into a more of a sustainable, to lessen the repetitive damage. And if you look at studies through FEMA and other, the Pew Research, every dollar we spend in post-disaster mitigation will save us $6 in repetitive costs. So that's really where we, where our major work happens. The second is we serve as the administrative agency, state's administrative agency for FEMA when it deals with their building resilient infrastructure and community program. So first let's talk about post-disaster mitigation. That occurs, we get a percentage after every presidential disaster that happens within the borders of the state of Minnesota. Currently, from 2022, we are working with three of those that happened last year. So that our division then receives a percentage, and then we will solicit local, county, and tribal projects to then fund. Look at those for cost-benefit analysis, what's the best that we can do. For example, up in the Duluth area, repetitive damage on the shoreline, we've been working with them for several years on that to make sure that we can make that as sustainable as possible and not have to continue to pay for that. The challenge with those is there's a 25% local match. FEMA pays the 75%, so there's a 25% local match. So that does hamper our ability with some of those local jurisdictions that can't come up with that 25% match. Secondly, are some of those examples that we've dealt with over the years on those. We've done tornado safe rooms. We've done agricultural ditches, replaced those to help with water flow in some of the out greater Minnesota. We've hardened some power lines for things like today with ice. We've done that in the northwest part of the state. We in the northeast part of the state, we've worked with sprinkler systems on properties to affect wildfires, as we see in those. And then a large part of the thing is a backup generation for critical infrastructure. How do we then right size so that we can keep some of our infrastructure still going after disaster? We've partnered with the University of Minnesota Duluth with some of these disaster funds to help local communities develop mitigation planning. So part of the challenge also with post-disaster mitigation is if a county does not have a plan approved by FEMA, they become ineligible for funding. So we work with University of Minnesota Duluth. They have a great program so that we can help the locals make sure that that is updated every 5 years and they can participate in the program. Luckily, they have a very good standing with our local communities. When we talk about the BRIC program, it's a national competitive program with a set aside for each state. Last year in 2022, the state received $1 million for local projects. This year we're supposed to get $2 million and the rest of that ends up being competitive. The challenge there is the national priorities are large cost-benefit challenges. So we in the upper Midwest and our region is Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and us have only received one project over the last 2 years of this program. Most of that goes to California wildfires and some of the infrastructure issues they have there, earthquakes, repetitive damage due to hurricanes, and things like that. So we are sort of in a disadvantage here in the upper Midwest. We will continue to apply for those, and we look at it in two ways. We will continue to support our locals to continue to apply for that. We also sit on the review of those from other states to hone our staff skill to look at what's being approved throughout the nation so we can try to help our locals decide what projects we actually will get through and we can start to work with that. And then on that front, there's all the states through the National Emergency Management Association and local other national association is working with FEMA to try to better look at how do we divide up that money more equitably across the United States, understanding that there are regions that do have more damage. So we'll continue to work on that. And I believe over the next few years, this is only the second year of that BRIC program, I believe over the next few years we'll be able to right-size or that'll balance out a little bit, and we'll continue to work for our local communities and make sure that they recover and build resilient as we move forward. That was quick. The two things work about it, but I want to make sure that we're good with your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And again, if members want to follow up with Mr. Reed offline, and we can always invite them back. I want to thank you all for your patience. And I just love how engaged this committee is. So, yeah. So with that, I will adjourn the committee.